Welcome to Mysterious Universe Plus, Season 22, Episode 17. Coming up on the show, we've got the blessing of the Golden Torch, the super fun times in between Yugas, and the lasers of the Malaysian mini monsters. I'm Benjamin Grundy, joining me is Aaron Wright.
I tried to catch you with that one with multiple M's, but it didn't really work.
It sounds great. Yeah. Malaysian mini monsters. How are they different to regular monsters?
Well, they're just mini. Yeah, that's exactly right. You've got monsters and mini monsters.
Is this going on from the mini-oids that you mentioned
it is.
A couple of episodes
yeah,
ago?
Yeah, it is flowing on from that. Actually, I've been quite taken with the work of Simon Harvey Wilson.
Oh, and the world's leader in mini-oids research.
Well, no, not necessarily, but the reason why I got into it is because it crosses over into this weird element of UFO phenomenon that suggests that, look, he's not directly saying this, but he's saying that a lot of the things that we see, you know, according to some researchers, may actually not be extraterrestrial at all. Even though it looks like a little mini saucer lands and, you know, 2-inch or 3-inch little aliens climb out of it, it might be part of some type of extension of something like Project Bluebeam or MK Ultra in a way. This whole idea of, he makes this statement that, is it possible that there could be warring factions within governments that are in the deep kind of hidden parts of the government, in the black ops kind of, you know,
deep
black
state. Budget,
the deep state kind of stuff, where essentially they're trying to make aliens look bad. So in doing so, they hoax it with holograms and people get injured. But it forms this kind of more disturbing kind of idea that it's part of the military-industrial complex testing their weapons.
Isn't this what Stephen Greer says, that all abductions are some kind of black ops program?
Yeah, it's kind of, well, look, he doesn't go Stephen Greer. He doesn't go that far down the path of madness. But in the arguments that he puts forward, it's actually quite intriguing. So coming up in this episode, I'm going to go into some of these stories of the utilization of strange laser and maser weaponry that seems to be attached to UFOs.
Okay.
And how it might actually be separate factions of human beings that are just simply copying extraterrestrials and pinning it on them, essentially.
Okay.
So aliens are bad, we're good.
Nice to just boil it down to
a
binary.
That's exactly what it is. It's binary.
Well, I couldn't resist Bibu Dev Misra, this author that had a few articles up on Graham Hancock's website.
All right.
Remember I mentioned there was this guy that cracked the Yuga cycles?
Yeah.
It's this guy. His website is bibudevmisra.com. I'll link to it in the show notes. But this article is one of his most popular. And I can tell why, because every time we've covered the Yuga cycles in the past, the idea of these very long periods of time that essentially are cosmic cycles that influence the development of human knowledge, human spirituality, human civilization. In the golden age Yugas, everything's magical and wonderful and everyone drinks manna from the heavens.
But it's always...
No one has a want. It's basically utopia.
Yeah, but it's always so cool. But the problem is, like, the concept of it, but it's just so long. Those periods are just so long that you just go, who cares?
Yeah, so last time we covered it, I think you asked me, well, when do we get out of this Kali Yuga? Because we're in the Kali Yuga now, which
it's
is...
It's a mess.
Which is, yeah, when everything falls apart and there's no morality and mankind's knowledge is basically zero and it's a freak show. And yeah, how long does it take for us to get out of this mess? And the answer was like 1.1 million years or something.
We're just gonna... Well, I can't wait that long.
It's like thousands and thousands of reincarnations here. But Misra is saying that this is wrong. It's all wrong. The calculations, even in some of the ancient texts, they're wrong. And they've been manipulated on purpose throughout history.
Why? Why would you manipulate them?
Well, it's got to do with this larger cycle of 4.32 million years. But I'll get to that in a moment. Again, he claims they're all wrong. So let me just kick it off. For those of you who might be new to PLUS and you haven't heard us discuss the Yugas before, the original description comes from the Mahabharata. And it describes our period, our cycle, as the period when the world's soul is black and only one quarter of virtue remains, which slowly dwindles to zero at the end of the Kali Yuga.
So about the end of now, essentially.
Well, depending on which version of history you're looking at, whether it's the larger cycle or what Misra is arguing. Essentially, men turn to wickedness, disease, lethargy, anger, natural calamities, anguish and fear and scarcity dominate. penance, sacrifices, and religious observances all fall into disuse. All creatures degenerate, and change passes over all things without exception. So, a lot of fun. But when did the Kali Yuga actually begin, and when will it end? This is the question that we always come to. So he points out that the start and end dates of the Kali Yuga, they're actually really shrouded in mystery, and they're very hard to narrow down. He says the popular date for the beginning of the cycle we're in now, this Kali Yuga, is 3102 BCE. That's 35 years after the conclusion of the Battle of the Mahabharata, that big war, that huge battle that took place. Now, the reason that scholars lock into that date, 3102 BCE, is there's a statement made by this really noted ancient astronomer from India, ancient India. His name was Aryabhatta. And there's this Sanskrit text essentially attributed to his name where he writes, when 60 times 60 years, which is 3,600 years, and three-quarter yugas had elapsed, 23 years had then passed since my birth. So it's kind of a bit of a simple riddle, but he's basically saying he was 23 years old and 3,600 years had already passed in the current yuga he was in, that current cycle he was in. There's only one problem with this. We've got no idea when this guy was born. So that statement of him being 23 years old and it was already 3,600 in, we can't use it.
Yeah.
And this is really what Misra is arguing. Scholars have based it on this idea that this guy was alive around this time, but we have no evidence of when he actually wrote this. So again, you're kind of shooting in the dark. You're just guessing. So scholars just basically assume that the Kali Yuga started in 3102 BCE, and they use this statement from that ancient Sanskrit text to lock it in. But he says, the truth is that there's no text or inscription which gives us an unambiguous date for the beginning of the Kali Yuga. He says the popular date of 3102 BCE has basically no basis for it. There's no astronomical basis for it. There's no historical basis for it. And figuring out when the Yuga cycle starts is really, really tricky because he argues there's all these errors that have been inserted into the Sanskrit texts, as I said. For example, in many of the texts, that 12,000-year total cycle duration, because originally it was thought that the whole cycle of, you know, this Yuga is 12,000 years and it's broken into these separate sections. That's been inflated to that massive 4.32 million years that we've mentioned on past segments. And I've always had difficulty with it because, you know, I'll read one book from someone that's writing about yugas and they'll use one reference that adds up to this insane number. And then someone else will mention another number and there's no cohesion to it all. It's all over the place.
Well, it's different interpretations. So as a result, you find yourself not being able to get a conclusive answer.
Well, Misra pointed out a lot of this confusion was introduced in one of the later Sanskrit texts because they started to argue that you needed to calculate by divine years and human years.
Uh-huh.
Remember that? We've discussed that on previous segments before.
Yeah.
So the idea of a divine year was that it was 360 human years. So instead of the original kind of 12,000 years, you now had to times that by 360.
So here's where you get the inflation.
And then you get this massive inflation, then you times that by something else, and eventually you've got all these millions of years. And it just didn't really make sense. So he believes we should actually refer to the Mahabharata and another text called the Laws of Manu, which scholars believe are actually before these Sanskrit texts that do the divine years thing. These are earlier texts. They claim the original value of 12,000 years for the whole cycle. Now, where I think he might be correct is this 12,000-year calculation correlates with other cultures. So, for example, the Zoroastrians also believed in a cycle of the ages, which was 12,000 years.
Yep.
There's the great year or the perfect year of the Greeks, which was said by Cicero to be 12,954 years, so a lot closer. Or Heraclitus calculated it to be 10,800 years duration.
But still in that ballpark as opposed to millions.
Well, that 10,800 years is really important, so hang on to that number. It seems like it's out, but it's actually not. So he says, surely the Yuga cycle can't be different durations for different cultures, because the argument is that it's some kind of cosmic influence. It's universal to everyone on the planet.
Yeah.
Now, in the book Holy Science from 1894 by the scholar Sri Yukteswar, there's a clarification from him. He claims that, yes, it's a 12,000-year duration, but that's just one of the arcs of the cycle. So if you think of the whole yuga cycle as a giant circle, there's an ascension up. You're going up one half and then down the other way to form the circle. So there's 12,000 years up and there's 12,000 years down.
Uh-huh.
So to clarify, the yuga cycle we're in now is actually past the bottom of the circle. We're actually on the way up.
No.
Because there's two Kali Yuga cycles right at the bottom. So it goes from the Golden Age all the way to the top, down to the Middle Age, and into the Kali Yuga, and then there's another Kali Yuga, and you start up into the Middle Age and eventually into the Golden Age.
So does it get better as it goes up?
Yeah, that's
right. When you hit the Golden Age?
That's right. It gets better. We're in the ascension up.
Well, that's positive.
Out of the mud. It's positive if it's a couple of years away. If it's a million years away, who gives a shit?
Yeah, exactly.
No one cares. So he clarified there's this ascending and descending cycle. And again, this correlates elsewhere. So it's starting to look like we're on the right track. This 24,000-year duration of the complete yuga cycle is very close to the precessional year. The precessional year is 25,765. So it's in the ballpark. And interestingly, this scholar, Surya Siddhanta, he specifies in ancient India that there's 54 arc seconds per year for the precession, which is against the current value we use today, which is 50.29. And when you translate the 54 arc seconds, it actually adds up to 24,000 years for an entire precessional year.
So he's saying that there's astronomical basis for, I guess, the timing of the yuga.
Yeah, it's like at the moment we've deviated from the mean. It's like the mean in history was always 54 arc seconds. And then something happens, maybe in the Kali Yuga, when things go awry, all sorts of astronomical things like get out of whack as well. Like maybe it's the whole solar system or galaxy that starts to decline and go through a cycle as well, if you think on the macro level. So we're kind of out of this historical 54 arc seconds for the precession. But the ancient precession was meant to be 24,000 years instead of the 25,765 that we calculate today. So there's something to that as well. And the ancient Greeks also appear to have believed in ascending and descending cycles of ages. The Greek poet Hesiod, who was from 750 BCE to 650 BCE, he gave an account of the world ages in his work, Works and Days, and he inserted this fifth age called the Age of Heroes. So he had, you know, the Golden Age and Silver Age and Bronze Age and Iron Age. And he inserted this extra section, the Age of Heroes. And basically, what he figured out is that at the end of the Age of Iron, it divides into two, and then it's like the cycle arcs up again, almost like the Indian way that we're ascending up the Kali Yuga again. So they had, like, we've got two Kali Yugas. We just came out of one, and we're into another one now.
So then
the ancient Greeks had the same thing. They had this Iron Age and then the Age of Heroes, this little double section at the bottom of the cycle.
So what came after the Age of Heroes? Was that the Bronze Age?
They're going up again. So they're going back into the Bronze Age then in... No.
But the Bronze Age collapsed.
That's not the same reference.
Oh, I see.
The Bronze Age we refer to because they were using bronze.
Right.
He's talking about...
Oh, this is like as in Olympic medals, like gold, silver and bronze kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a better way to think of it. He's not talking about the technology because he was before though. Like he was in the Bronze Age.
I'm thinking, how would he even know?
Yeah. So there's, again, there's correlations in the ancient Greeks. It reverses itself just like the Yugas. The scholar Vinant also states that the Iron Age has two parts. Again, this corresponds to Indian scholars who, like I said, believe the Kali Yuga has these two parts. And again, the evidence from different sources supports the notion of a complete Yuga cycle of 24,000 years, this descending and then ascending arc. And this brings us to the question of the relative durations of the different Yugas in that cycle. So how long is each period? You know, is the Golden Age 4,000 years and then the Middle Age is another 4,000 years, or does it differ? Because in the original yugas from the Sanskrit texts, Many of them state that the Golden Age is 4,800 years. The Silver Age is 3,600 years. The, what do you call after that? The Bronze Age is 2,400. And then the final toilet stage is 1,200. So it gets smaller. The cycle length gets smaller as you go down. Now, this is another thing where Misra says it's wrong. It's basically wrong. He says in the few accounts where the durations of the yugas are specified, we find that each age in the yuga cycle is of the same duration.
That makes sense.
That's if you're looking at other cultures as well. He points out that there's about 30 ancient cultures that mention these types of cycles. Now, most of them don't mention the length, but the ones that do, like the Zoroastrians, for example, they believe that the world lasts for 12,000 years, but each section is divided into four equal ages of 3,000 years each. There's even a Mexican source known as the Codex Rios. It states that each age is 4,008 years, 4,010, 4,801, and 5,042. It's a little bit off, but it's still in the same ballpark. They're not, you know, massively different figures. They're nearly the same. So again, Misra is harping on this idea that, look, some of those later Sanskrit texts, they screwed it up. They got it wrong. They changed it, or they added something, or they did their own calculations and they screwed it up. It's wrong. It deviates from the norm. So he says that progression that you read in Sanskrit, 4,800 to 3,600 years to 2,400 years to 1,200 years, it's this weird progression that you don't find in natural cycles. It's not in nature. You know, whereas when nature divides cycles, they're generally even.
Yeah, well, look at the seasons, for example.
Exactly.
It feels almost like anyone in the past who's deciphered this or interpreted this has basically forgotten to carry the one.
Yeah, they've made a mistake somewhere.
Yeah.
He says, could it be that the yuga durations were deliberately altered at some point in the past in order to give the impression that the duration of each yuga decreases in tandem with the decrease in virtue? That's what he claims has happened. But they've tried to kind of make it match their particular circumstances.
What's the motivation? Is it like when you go to a shitty school and you try to make out like it's not that bad? So is it that kind of thing?
Well,
like
one of the arguments is that, and I guess this will be explained in a moment, so I won't say too much about it.
Sure.
But there's certain periods where there's chaos and libraries are destroyed, knowledge is destroyed,
yeah,
and very little information is left over, and essentially the wise men that survive these cataclysms try and rebuild the knowledge of the past.
But how much can you rebuild when it's all been destroyed?
Well, you kind of got to fill in the gaps sometimes.
Yeah.
And they get it wrong. That's the argument. So
it's not deliberate. It doesn't seem like it's malicious.
Who knows? Well, Misra also points out that there's two we could argue the most famous astronomers in ancient Indian history. If you look at their works, they actually concur that the cycles are the same length. There's Aryabhata and Paulisa. Again, they both state that the cycles are 3,000 years each, and there's four of them. So where we get into the first clue as to how he thinks he's cracked this is there's actually, he claims it's very simple. It's a very simple calculation to figure out the lengths of these yugas. 12,000 years is the whole cycle. Each yuga lasts for 3,000 years. This same cycle is in the ancient Saptarshi calendar. Now, this is an ancient calendar that was used in India for thousands of years, and it has the same calculations in it. It was used extensively during the Moira period in the 4th century BCE. Apparently, it's still used in some parts of India today. And the term Saptarshi, the Saptarshi calendar, it actually refers to the seven rishis. And the seven rishis, it's this idea of they're like sages, they're like masters. And these seven masters always show up after everything's gone to hell.
So at the end of the 12,000 year cycle?
Well,
or every 3,000 year cycle?
At the end of every mini cycle.
Okay, so every 3,000 years.
Every 3,000 years, these seven guys turn up.
And they're like, what happened here?
Yeah, they're basically like, look at this mess, buddy. Let's clean up. They realize that everything's gone to hell and they have to teach everyone how to wipe their asses again and clean their caves, basically.
Wow.
The seven rishis.
And this is obviously, I mean, even though it's part of Indian culture. This must be a belief that it's a global, universal kind of thing that happens.
Yeah. So I guess you could kind of say the same thing for, you know, the great kings that followed Noah, for example. And there's many examples in cultures all around the world. But he's saying this calendar, it's got a cycle of 2,700 years.
So where's the 300 years gone?
So, yeah, what happens to that missing 300? Why is there a discrepancy of 300 years? Well, this is what really breaks the whole thing open. He says these 300 years are the transitional periods in between those yuga cycles. So you got 2,700 years, 300-year transition. 2,700 years, 300-year transition.
So does that mean that 300-year transition, is that a period of chaos, like a mini period of chaos?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
So,
but why? Why does it have to be?
Well, during these transitional periods, it's the time before the qualities of the next yuga are fully manifested in people, in civilization, in thinking and abilities.
So you're saying like it needs to be in their hearts?
Well, it's in everything. It's this idea of a cosmic influence mm-hmm. on everything, like the animal kingdom and everything around us. So it takes a while to fully set in. It's like it's a software update. And there's a loading bar, and that loading bar is 300 years.
Yeah, you're going to sit and wait for 40 minutes while your laptop updates.
But there's assets loading while you're watching that loading bar. It's not like nothing's happening. There's just not a blank loading screen. There's like, you know, the landscape comes up, and then you different textures come up to use a video game reference. So it's kind of like you got to think of it as the yuga loading. So if you were going to go into the golden age, you would start to see over that 300-year period things getting better and better and better and better and better
until prosperity, post-scarcity.
Until it's finally in that, you know, utopia, golden age. Now, amazingly, this has another Greek correlation. So that total duration of the yuga cycle, if you take out the transitional periods, that's 2,700 years times 4, which is 10,800 years.
Ah, okay.
Which was that number I said to remember earlier. That's from...
was it Greeks, wasn't it?
Heraclitus?
Yeah.
Heraclitus? That was his number, 10,800 years. So it matches the Hellenic tradition. It matches the ancient Greeks.
Why then dismiss, though, those 300 years? Because obviously it's part of it.
It's like... Again, it's the idea that it's ancient knowledge that's been copied from somewhere. It's like he got that number from somewhere.
Yeah.
He knew it was some kind of ancient wisdom. But because it was, you know, murked by the passage of time, there wasn't a full understanding of it. Now, this is where it gets interesting because he says that Saptarshi era, that calendar of the 2,700 years plus the 300-year transitional periods, we know when that era began. We've got a date for that. It started in 6676 BCE, and another cycle started exactly 3,000 years later in 3676 BCE.
So how do we know that from astronomical phenomena?
No, we actually know when the Saptarshi people were in Rohini, and that's 3676 BCE. So it implies that the Kali Yuga cycle commenced when they started that calendar, 3,676 BCE. We've got a date to peg it to. We've got something solid to peg it to. So he's arguing, and the way that this progresses, it kind of locks into place. And he says the entire timeline of the yuga cycle unravels. He says this yuga cycle timeline, if you use that date as the peg, takes us to the beginning of the golden age, which is 12,676 BCE, 14,500 years before present day. So we now have something to follow. So we can now investigate whether his timeline actually matches up with historical events.
And does it?
Well, before we go into that, as an aside, because we have this timeline now, we now know precisely when we get out of this Kali Yuga period that we're in now, this toilet stage, 2025. I mentioned it on the last show. Remember, 2025.
Then
we go into a transitional period.
Uh-oh. Didn't you say that was a period of...
You kind of jumped the gun there. So the question is, okay, we make it to 2025. What happens in these transitional periods, that 300-year period after 2025?
Oh, no.
Oh, God.
Well, enlighten us.
According to the Yuga cycle doctrine, he says, the transitional periods between the Yugas are associated with a collapse of civilizations and environmental catastrophes. It wipes out virtually every trace of any human civilization on the planet. The new civilization that emerges is the new Yuga, guided by a few survivors of the cataclysm who carry with them the technical and spiritual knowledge of the previous epoch. Many ancient sources tell us of the enigmatic group of seven sages. Again, these seven rishis turn up to help kickstart things, to help get things going. So we find them in myths across the world. They're in Sumeria, India, Polynesia, South America, North America. They possess infinite wisdom. They can travel over the land. They can go anywhere they want. And
they're basically like the Star Trek version of omnipotent beings that can just kind of appear anywhere. And
yeah, like remember, like what's an example? The Islanders, like the Solomon Islanders, believe they came in flying canoes.
Yeah,
you know,
their cultural interpretation of these omnipotent beings.
Yeah, who wanted to kick these masters that wanted to kickstart civilization again. But if this is the case, if Mishra has nailed it here. Again, surely we can look back through history and see if these transitional periods correlate with times of ancient cataclysms.
But what is this? The Matrix? What, it just reboots every cycle?
Well, let's look at this first transitional period. So we've come out of the Golden Age and we're transitioning out of the Golden Age. So that leaves us at 9,976 to 9,676 BCE. It's a 300-year period. So this is the time when the last ice age suddenly came to an end and the world became really, really warm abruptly and there was a catastrophic global flood. Maybe it's coincidence.
Which kind of shows up in religious texts?
Maybe this is a coincidence that this lines up.
Cultural folklore?
This is also when Plato tells us that Atlantis was swallowed up by the sea in a single day in 9,600 BCE. It lines up. The Zoroastrians believe the world was created by Ahura Mazda at around 9,600 BCE. Mishra points out this event has also been recorded in the flood myths of many ancient cultures, which almost uniformly talk of enormous walls of water that submerge the entire land to the highest mountaintops. And we've recently just spoken about these flood myths on the show. They're everywhere. Archaeologist Bruce Mass of the Los Alamos National Labs in New Mexico examined a sample of 175 flood myths from different cultures around the world and said, look, there's environmental aspects in these events that are described, and it's consistent with archaeological and geophysical data. There was a destructive deep water oceanic comet impact that caused this. And then this leads us into the theories of the Younger Dryas period, which is smack bang in this transitional period, especially the end of the Younger Dryas. The Younger Dryas lasted till 9,700 BCE, and we saw the extinction of the megafauna. We saw the Clovis culture destroyed. So it all kind of lines up. There's chaos in this 300-year period.
But what I don't understand is if there was a comet that hit the planet and caused, you know, a massive flood, or if there was some type of environmental disaster, it seems like it's all random. But if you believe in the Yugas, this suggests that this is all somehow orchestrated and it happens every, 3,000 years?
Like there's a code running.
Yeah. I mean, again, we're back to the simulation hypothesis.
Asteroid.exe was set to run at 9,700 BCE.
But you see what I mean? Like, I can actually believe, like the idea of the Younger Dryas, and, you know, Graham Hancock has spoken about it extensively. It actually makes sense. It makes sense that 12,000 years ago, there was some terrible calamity that essentially wiped out and reset civilization. Yeah. But I get it if it was a random event, but this is suggesting that it's not random at all.
Yeah, I mean, that's insightful because I think it does suggest that. And if you look at the end of this 300-year transition period, remember, it's 9,676 BCE. And Mishra quotes the work of Jorgen Stephenson, who's a geologist from Copenhagen. He stated that the Ice Age, like it ended in 9,703 BCE, but he said in the transition from the Ice Age to our current warm interglacial period, the climate shift was so sudden, it was like a button was pressed. Like little tap on a keyboard. Boop. Okay, we're ready for the next era.
You want to change the temperature. Just press the button, away you go.
So there's a simulation reference for you. So again, Mishra's saying this is weird. Like it validates the Yuga cycle timeline. It lines up, but maybe it's just a coincidence. Surely the next transition period doesn't line up with anything. The end of the Silver Age or the Treta Yuga, that wrapped up and the transition period started at 6,976 BCE. Again, 300 years. So it went to 6,676 BCE. Did anything happen then? Well, there was the Black Sea catastrophe dated at exactly 6,700 BCE.
What was that?
The Black Sea used to be a huge freshwater lake. And around that time of the transition period, all these glaciers started to melt and it breached this natural dam. And this area called the Bosphorus Strait was kind of flooded and it flooded the entire Black Sea. It basically raised the water levels of the Black Sea by several hundred feet and flooded more than 60,000 square miles of land.
Which granted it access to the ocean, hence there's salt there now?
It expanded the Black Sea shoreline by 30%. So this would have destroyed any civilizations, anyone that was living there, livestock, farmland, everything would have just been wiped out. They say it fundamentally changed the course of civilization in southeastern Europe. Geologists Bill Ryan and Walter Pittman in New York, they first proposed the Black Sea catastrophe hypothesis, and they've actually compared it to Noah's flood. Like it was insane how much water was suddenly released. And Mishra points out there's similar flooding events all over the world, where these massive glacial lakes started to swell because ice was melting and it would breach these natural ice barriers and basically flood the surrounding area. You've got a similar thing between 6,900 BCE and 6,200 BCE. There's the Laurentide ice sheet, disintegrated in the Hudson Bay. And this inland lake, Lake Agassiz or Ojibwe, just discharged, into the sea, and single-handedly, they said, raised the global sea level by half a meter.
That's a lot of water.
Yeah. So anywhere that was a coastal city could have been kind of screwed. This period between 7,000 BCE and 6,000 BCE was also characterized by the occurrence of gigantic earthquakes in Europe. In northern Sweden, some of these earthquakes caused waves on the ground that were 10 meters high. They were referred to as rock tsunamis. It is possible that the global chain of cataclysmic events during this period may have been triggered by a single underlying cause, but Mishra points out, if it is, we don't know what caused it. But again, everything fell in to this 300-year transitional period. Again, is it another coincidence?
Well, I mean, it could be coincidence.
Is he cherry picking?
Yeah, I mean, this is what I'm wondering. Is it a coincidence that, yeah, I mean, disasters always happen. There's always, I guess the difference is that these are significant civilization ending disasters. And it lines up with a tradition that describes the end of civilization.
Yeah, so let's look at the next transitional period. This is the Dwapara Yuga into the Kali Yuga. So you could say the Bronze Age into the Iron Age. 3,976 BCE, 300 years later, it ends in 3,676 BCE. Again, a series of environmental cataclysms. And no one really knows why. No one understands what kicked it off. It's referred to in geology as the 5.9 kilo year event. And it's considered one of the most intense aridification events during the Holocene period. It occurred around 3,900 BCE, and it basically initiated the desiccation of the Sahara Desert. At the same time, between 4,000 and 3,500 BCE, the coastal plains of Sumer experienced severe flooding. This basically had a massive impact on the areas around it and in Asia as well. This catastrophic flooding led to a worldwide migration to river valleys, so that's what eventually led to Mesopotamia and Egypt and the Indus Valley kickstarting in the next cycle in 3,500 BCE.
Right.
This transitional period pushed these people out to these different areas. And again, there's this amazing Old Testament correlation, because this transitional period is recorded in ancient calendars. So we all know, you know, this old trope that for a long time there was this belief in the Western world that the world was created in, what was it, like 4000 BCE, right? That was the date, 4004 BCE. And they used the Old Testament to basically try and add up this creation of the world date. And that's what they landed on, 4004 BCE. That date is just 28 years prior to the end of that yuga cycle. It's right in that transition period.
Another coincidence.
Now, if you look at the Jewish religion as well, their calendar starts, the world creation date that they have is 3761 BCE. Again, right in the middle of that transitional period. So if you've got two of the biggest religions in the world saying, oh no, our world started, our cycle started in this transitional period. It's kind of bizarre. Like it's lining up. I think this guy might have unlocked it.
Well, it's also pretty cool in the idea as well that, you know, and we've discussed this idea that there were previous, you know, advanced civilizations that existed on planet Earth that had developed incredible technologies but got wiped out. And, you know, modern archaeology says, oh, no, that can't happen. But when you align it with the Yugas, it makes absolute sense.
And it just so happens that Atlantis, which was considered, you know, this incredibly advanced ancient civilization, when that was wiped out was at the end of the Golden Age.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that it was incredibly advanced. Now, let's look at the next, the end of the last Kali Yuga and the transition into our Kali Yuga that we're in now. So this period was 976 to 676 BCE. Anything happened then? Anything bad happened?
Some fire, water, something.
This is the Greek Dark Ages.
Oh.
So this is the period essentially after the collapse of the Bronze Age, as in the our technology understanding of
right.
the Bronze Age.
Olives run out, we're screwed.
Historians regard the Greek Dark Ages as a period of transition from the late Bronze Age to the early Iron Age era. The historian Robert Drews writes that, and listen to this because this is scary. Within a period of 40 to 50 years at the end of the 13th and the beginning of the 12th century, almost every significant city in the Eastern Mediterranean world was destroyed, many of them never to be occupied again. Every major city. Every significant city, gone, destroyed. 50-year period.
Yeah.
What happened to you?
Well, in a way, though, depending on, you know, the power of whatever the disaster is, like 50 years isn't that long.
But that disaster, my understanding of it, which isn't comprehensive by any means, is it was an economic collapse. It was like a breakdown of a complex system. It wasn't.
Ah.
It wasn't climate change or some kind of rock tsunami. I mean, that might have played a role in breaking down certain parts of the complex system, but it was a system collapse that caused it. It was a complex system falling in on itself. Now, if there's anything that would take us out,
it would be
something like that, like the collapse of a complex system.
By the way, that's going to happen.
Well, 2025, we don't know what's going to happen. This sudden and violent disruption, he said, plunged the entire Near East, North Africa, Caucasus, the Aegean, the Balkan regions into a dark age that lasted for how long?
300 years.
300 years. Mm-hmm. It was characterized by great upheavals, famine, depopulation, mass movements of people. Almost every city between Pylos and Gaza was violently destroyed and many abandoned. The palace economies of the Mycenaeans and the Anatolia collapsed and people lived in isolated small settlements. Now, amazingly, we're not just looking at the Mediterranean and the Middle East and Europe at these collapses. In Egypt, there was this same period as well. It's known as the Third Intermediate Period, where Egypt was overrun by foreign rulers. There was political and social disintegration. There was chaos accompanied by crippling droughts. In India, the Indus Valley civilization basically ended in this period as well. And the catastrophe also struck the Olmecs. There was a wholesale destruction of many of these monuments that occurred in 950 BCE, and the site was abandoned in 900 BCE. So even the Americas was affected in this transitional period. Because it is a global cosmic force. Well, it's a cosmic force. It affects everything. Now, amazingly, in this period as well, you get to the end of this transitional period or in the middle of this transitional period, this is where the seven rishis start showing up. So all these philosophers and prophets, they appear on the scene. Buddha, 623 BCE, Buddha Sakyamuni is born. Immediately a year later, 624 BCE, you've got Thales, considered, you know, the first great Greek philosopher, considered one of the seven wise rishis.
Yeah, right.
He's born. You've got Pythagoras, 570 BCE, Confucius, 551 BCE, Zoroaster, 600 BCE, Mahavira Jain, 599 BCE. He's the Jainism guy, right?
I don't know him.
I don't know him there very well. So you have all these masters showing up in this 300-year transition to kickstart civilization again. And here we are today, sitting in our studio with our air conditioning and our furry sound treatment.
But then how far? So if we've got 2025 and we enter back into a 300-year transitionary period, how rapidly does society decline? Does it happen at 2025 or?
Well, that's when the transition period starts, but who knows? I mean, if you look at the previous cycle, you had that example of all those major cities being gone within 40 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So is that going to be the same for us?
Well, if you're saying economic collapse, and, you know, I was being facetious before, but we actually do, you know, stand in this predicament as a result of lockdowns and the pandemic.
Yeah.
We are facing essentially a severe financial problem, and it's being hidden up. Like, it's being kind of, oh no, everything's going wonderfully. It's not. Things are financially not looking good for the world.
It's like the damage hasn't come down the
pipeline.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's going to take time. And you know when it really will actually finally hit? Around 2025.
Oh, good for you.
Really? 2025?
That's about the time.
You're just pulling that out of your ass.
No. I was reading an article the other day, this idea about the flow-on effect of not just supply chains, but essentially what happens is that now we've got all these lockdowns. The damage to the economy takes about a year to kick in for people to actually start having issues. Then there's about a three-year period of where everything starts to kind of slowly kind of fold in on itself. And then following that, normally there's another year period if you don't pull out in that 3 years.
Holy crap.
Before total economic collapse.
2025.
It's about 2025. And I was like, oh, no, that's garbage. Because like, the guy that was reading was like normally very, like he's just one level below Jim Rickards.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh, no. It's like, it makes sense. Like if you look at the depression and the way that things have happened, although the depression happened very rapidly. But yeah, like, oh, and now you're mentioning this, it kind of lines up.
Well, looking to the future, Mishra says, in that 300-year transition, you can almost break it into two sections. So the first 150 years is called the twilight of the Kali, where things are still unraveling. Like structures might keep going, but they're in the process of collapse. And you might have, he says, wars, environmental catastrophes, cosmic changes, and all of that is kind of easing out into the next 150 years, which is where the spiritually evolved systems and the philosophies of the next yuga start to emerge. And they are the more enlightened, wiser, you know, higher principles that start to lay their foundations into society, and then boom, we're into the next yuga cycle.
It's funny though that it should be described that way, because you wouldn't imagine after a terrible disaster like that you would have these, you know, heightened, you know, moral principles coming out of something like that. You'd expect it to be a mess.
Maybe people start to prioritize things differently when...
Yeah, probably.
There's no TV or social media to turn
on.
Good
point.
Like, there's nothing...
Yeah.
It just comes back down to real basics.
Yeah.
You know, you're not...
Family and sticking together so you can survive and production and, yeah, I guess that, you know...
Eating
farming.
Bush turkeys and possums.
Yeah, well, that's what we'll have in Australia. Do you know how hard those things are to catch as well? Well, not the turkeys, they're easy.
I was going down my driveway the other day and a bush turkey ran in front of the car. And then instead of running across my driveway,
it kept running
in front of my car.
They do that around my place too, yeah.
And it did it for like 50 meters.
Yeah.
Like my dad and I were in the car, we were just laughing at this dumbass turkey.
Oh, they're lovely birds.
The dumbest animal I've ever seen.
They are pretty dumb. Yes, they are.
It could have gone left or right at any point.
No.
It just keeps running in front of the car. Although I did have a friend in high school that did that in front of a bus once.
Did he get hit?
No, he just missed.
Right, okay.
But he was equally as stupid as that bush turkey.
People panic.
So that is the end of the Kali Yuga, the unraveling of the mysteries of the Yuga cycle by Bibhu Dev Misra. So whenever you hear mention of the Yuga and someone points out that, oh, don't worry, we're in this hellscape for another 1.4 million years.
Relax.
Tell them it's not true. It's actually a lot of those Sanskrit texts, they mixed it up. They got it wrong. I think he's on the money when he says it's a Nita, 12,000-year ascending cycle, 12,000-year descending cycle, and each one is broken up into this 2,700-year period with a 300-year transition at the end.
So looking at this perspective, rather than it being thousands of reincarnations to actually get to the golden period, we're looking at about, you know, based on the idea that people reincarnate, what, every 70 years or so, you're kind of looking at, what, 4 or 5 max, maybe 6 to be on the safe side, reincarnations before you get to the golden period. So it's not that bad.
Well, how many years are in? So that's before the golden period. So if you come out of this age, you've got another couple of ages.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You want to put a few.
You probably want to hang out a bit before you reincarnate.
Mm.
Like if you die, you're listening to the show and you're having to die tomorrow, remember these words. Don't reincarnate straight away. Just back off.
Hang on for a while.
Hang out. Enjoy whatever it is that you do.
The in-between.
The in-between,
the in-between space, yes. Weird stuff. I mean, it's fascinating, though. And the Yugas, they always intrigue me. And I like it when you hear new kind of insight to it, like what we're getting here. Because I guess I'm going to have to go away and just do a little bit more research. Because for me, I really don't want to go down, I know I mentioned it a lot, but I don't want to go down the path of it being a simulation. But yet again, I mean, as you're saying, you know, you've got like temperature happening, you've got these perfectly orchestrated cycles occurring.
Yeah. And if you look at the you know, that graph that shows the ice core readings from Greenland and it's over like 30,000, 40,000 years.
Yeah.
And
then all of a sudden,
it's pretty stable for our modern era. And then you get to like 12,000 years ago, and it is like someone pulled a lever.
And then all of a sudden, civilization just blooms.
Like, forget about climate change now. It's nothing compared to 12,000 years ago. It doesn't even register on the graph. 12,000 years ago,
it was hot.
It's like a fucking roller coaster.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, tomorrow. Oh, good. It's minus 100 degrees today. Yeah. And this is lasting for 1,000 years.
And life can't, you know, function properly in those periods. Like it just can't. Like it will get through, but it doesn't thrive. And then all of a sudden, when civilization really takes off, it's because everything just suddenly perfectly stabilized.
Yeah. And today we're like, oh, 2 degrees. Oh, no. Oh.
That would be you for the most part. You get in my car every time. Like, oh, it's so cold in here. You turn it down. And then, of course, I get in the car later on to go home. Like, why is it so cold in here or so hot in here?
I have a cold constitution.
Yes.
I'm taking herbs.
Great. Are the herbs working?
Fire herbs.
Yeah, fire herbs.
That's what my acupuncturist prescribed me. Fire herbs.
Yeah, it's funny that you should go and have that done, because when I saw a acupuncturist and a herbalist years and years ago, she just says to me, she looks at me like she reads my pulse and just stares at me. She's like, you have too much heat.
Oh, you're right. We're opposites. That's hilarious.
It's like this weird yin and yang thing going on. It's like you're on fire inside. I'm like, oh, thank you very much. That's great to know. You know, actually, I was just looking at the collapse of the Black Sea, or that disaster that took place, and I wasn't aware of this, but the Black Sea is actually a location that has some of the most oldest shipwrecks in the world. Like there's shipwrecks from antiquity there, going all the way back to like really ancient times. And it's because apparently the lower layers of the Black Sea are deprived completely of oxygen.
Oh.
Like completely, and it's because of the way that the water has changed. So because they've got these lower layers of salt up the top, you've got this fresh water flowing in. So it never mixes. So at the bottom layers, it's this really, really clean, but oxygen deprived environment. So you've got all these wooden shipwrecks down there from ancient times.
That's cool.
That haven't been consumed by bacteria because there's no oxygen for them. Although there is anaerobic bacteria, but apparently there's not knocking off here. It's
really
fascinating.
That happens to our studio. Keeps us sealed in here forever.
And it floods here as well. So the floodwaters come over the top of the shipping container.
Yeah, some scuba diver comes in after 300 years and digs us up and we're just like,
hey, we waited here the whole time. All right, well, let's jump into the micronoids or the minioids, however you want to refer to it. But
I prefer minioids.
Minioids, I think minioids make it a little bit more exciting. Look, the reason why I came across this is because when I was looking into the research about, you know, invisibility and that kind of stuff, in the following journal article, the Journal of Alternative Realities, and this one was published in 1998. It's another article by Simon Harvey Wilson. And he was putting forward some really fascinating ideas, more focusing on the technologies that UFOs utilize. And most of that, of course, is light beam technologies. Mm-hmm. And when we think of light, we just think of something that is light. It's intangible, even though you can see it, but you can pass through it and you're not affected by it. It seems like, and we've discussed this, you know, in the work of, Leonard Stringfield, for example, that whenever people usually interact with lights coming out of UFOs, they seem to have a very strange, beyond our physical understanding property to them. They either are solid or they travel slowly or, you know, they have multiple effects. Sometimes they have healing effects, as, you know, mentioned by Preston Dennett in many of his stories. But also other times they have extremely detrimental and horrific effects. But I'll go into some of those stories in a moment and some of the experiences that people have had with them. But it ties in with this story that I read many, many, many years ago that was describing the whole concept of holograms being utilized. Now, this was published back in 2003. And it goes to this idea, following on from what Simon was referring to, that there's a possibility here that when people have experiences with extraterrestrials, they may not actually be extraterrestrials. Could they be something else? And, you know, human beings are capable of absolutely terrible things. So is it possible that human beings, as in the military-industrial complex, are testing their weapons on human beings, but happily allowing people to believe that it's extraterrestrials because it completely gets them off scot-free?
Would be a good cover.
It'd be an excellent cover. So what they do is, like, when Simon Harvey Wilson was describing some of these experiences, you know, you've got people, and Jenny Randalls did some really excellent research into this, into people that have essentially died after interacting with the light beams that come off of UFOs. So could it be, though, that this was some type of strange weapons testing that was being utilized? And it's not just weapons. It's also that you have to project some type of phenomenon around it so people focus on that. So what was described in this 2003 article that was titled Holograms and High Strangeness relates to a weird experience that happened in Argentina back in August of 2002. So back in August of 2002, there was this very strange flap of cattle mutilations. Now, immediately when I thought of cattle mutilations, I thought this is exactly what you hear from many researchers that speculate on what's going on here. Yes, you've got the whole, you know, main story that, well, it's aliens. It's aliens that are doing this. But is it necessarily, you know, and some have, you know, speculated that there's something more to it that, you know, and people have said satanic groups. I don't think so. It's far more advanced technology than that. But could it be the trialing of some type of special weaponry? And in 2007, there was a release of some DARPA information that described the utilization of stealth drones that were being utilized for field recovery. Now, some researchers have pointed out that that actually is more of a cover for possibly some type of cattle mutilation technology that was being utilized at the time. I think that's a little bit extreme for me because I don't know why DARPA would bother even doing that, but who knows what their motivations are. But if we go back to 2002, back into Argentina, this was actually witnessed by two women. One was Gabriela Lacinas, and the other one was Griselda Oliveira. Now, Gabriela was 15 and Griselda was 19. And they're out riding their bicycle at the back of, you know, this kind of small town. And as they're riding, it was just two friends spending the day together, as, you know, young kids do. And they said that they came across, just in the distance, this what appeared to be a massive ape-like figure that was standing in the middle of the road. Now, what is surreal about this, apart from the fact that you're seeing this massive ape-like figure, was that apparently it was over 15 feet in height and was wearing a ski outfit. Oh. Of some kind. The exact details of what the ski outfit are not detailed.
Tight-fitting?
Well, I'm assuming so.
His fur would be all puffy around the sleeves.
Maybe. Well, apparently he had extremely long arms that were outstretched in front of himself. He had spiky hair that seemed to be standing on end as if it was electrified. But the girl, this is a strange thing, the girl said that even though they're a little bit far back, they could still clearly make out this 15-foot giant that was before them. They couldn't see its face. The face seemed to be almost deliberately obfuscated or blurry. Like it was deliberately made blurry. Now you can see where I'm going with this, with the title of the article being like a hologram. Mm. Now the girls stood there and they gawked at this thing, as you would, because there's this towering thing before them. And they said there was almost a spell cast upon them, a similar kind of the Oz effect. It doesn't go into that detail, but you can tell that you get that feeling from it. And that will be really important when I describe some of the other cases later on. But what they were saying is that as they're watching, their attention was broken because they heard a car driving from behind them. So they're standing on the edge of the road watching this thing, and they turn to see this car. Now, this car drives up and stops just up from them, and they can clearly see the driver just staring at this thing. He apparently got out of the car, looks up at the figure in awe and in fear at the same time, suddenly has fear obviously just come over him like a wave.
Yeah.
He jumps back into the car and floors the vehicle. Now, when he floors the vehicle, he smashes through the 15-foot giant. He doesn't actually hit it. He goes straight through its legs, and not through like the part in its legs. It actually drives through the legs, such as the creature was some sort of illusion or mirage. So this caused the girls to completely snap out of this baffled daze that they were in. And for whatever reason, they seem, and maybe it's the folly of youth, but they seem to be fearless and start heading towards this creature. They start riding towards it.
Right.
Now, as they ride towards it, it's almost like this thing understands that it's going to be found out. It takes off from the ground. It hovers about 15 feet above the ground and then vanishes in a puff of black smoke. Black smoke? I mean, even if it was a hologram, though, why would it disappear in black smoke? Now, this story, as outrageous as it sounds, allegedly was validated by two researchers went in afterwards. One was Eduardo Lopez. They went in, they were local UFO investigators. They found, unrelated to these two girls, two farmhands who had been watching from the other side of the field who had seen exactly the same thing. These two researchers, based on other research they've been doing in the area, came to the conclusion that it was highly probable that this was some type of holographic image that was being tested in the area.
By whom and for what purpose? Why do they come to that conclusion? Just because it's non-physical?
They suggested that there was other research that they had which wasn't quoted, unfortunately.
Hmm.
So, and maybe, I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe it was just a stab in the dark. And the description of black smoke.
Because we've got heaps of stories of UFOs, you know, entering into the ground because they seem to be able to walk through, aliens walk through walls and they go through windows. The idea that this thing isn't physical for me doesn't immediately yell hologram.
You're absolutely right. The thing is, though, it fits a greater theme. And the greater theme is here is that only a few years later, there was actually a naval base in Argentina that had encounters with similar types of beings. And what I mean by that, they weren't 15-foot giants. They were beings that seemed to be able to be immaterial in form. They were partial mirages. And what they were is that the base was actually reporting on people that lived around the base. And it's obviously the people on the base that were reporting it was coming from people who wanted to remain, you know, silent about their identities. But what people were saying is that there were these strange, nebulous, partially transparent faces that seemingly looked like they were made from thin glass. They had red eyes. And what they would do is that they would float up every morning from behind the dunes, and they would start heading in the direction of the naval base. Now, as they headed towards the naval base, there were a couple of water tanks that were apparently located in this area. And these weird floating faces made of what seemed to be transparent, well, obviously glass is transparent, but it was more than transparent. It was, as I said, this partially transparent, weird glass-like material. They would actually approach these tanks. They would inspect the tanks, and then they would go through them. They would pass through them, and then they would pass through anything else that seemed to get in their way before disappearing just before they got to the naval base. Apparently, they would melt into the ground. Now, one detail that stands out here is that people said that when they came close to these things, and by close, we're talking, you know, 100 or so feet, but they said that the air around them seemed to become calm, still, and somewhat warmer, as if the beings or whatever was generating the beings was generating some type of heat wave. And apparently the area would become noticeably dimmer as well. So it was affecting not just the light in the area, but it was the temperature. It was the physical properties of the region that's around it. Now, what some people had suggested, some researchers at the time, unfortunately, again, you know, the researcher's name isn't included here, but it says that some of the researchers that looked into the matter speculated that the sightings could have been some sort of holographic experiment being conducted by the naval base on the local civilians.
Why would you make a hairy Bigfoot wearing a spandex suit as your holographic test program?
I really don't know. But I mean, I guess, think about it though, Ben. Like if you and I
did think about it. I find it absurd.
No, but I'm saying more along the lines, imagine if you or I were involved in like this really, you know, high level black project kind of stuff and you possessed holographic technology.
Imagine if I was in charge of the hologram.
Exactly. So could you imagine what absurd things you would, if you're running some type of psyop if you've got some type of program where you've got to create absurd things, 15-foot weird Bigfoot beings wearing snow, ski suits is potentially kind of something. I mean, I think that's rather actually kind of banal if you've got that ability. I mean, if you're creating something like that, you could go even more extreme, but apparently they did. So we head over to Cuba and we have to go back to April of 1982. Now, this is really bizarre because this was witnessed by apparently dozens of people on the ground. But in April of 1982, and you have to remember, you know, there's a whole heap of things that have been happening with the hostilities between Cuba and the US at the time. This idea that maybe there was some type of psyop that was going on between the countries. And even recently, you know, we've got those reports of the weird possible weapons, the psi weapons that are being used to cause, you know, the exploding head syndrome in diplomats. There's a lot of weird history here. So back in 82, apparently locals reported that there was a sudden flash of light in the sky. And when they looked up, they said what appeared to be forming was the face of a religious figure. Apparently it was the Cuban equivalent of the Blessed Virgin. Now it was hovering over them. It was wearing a brightly glowing mantle and its arms were outstretched towards the witnesses. The whole thing was incredibly impressive. Tens of dozens of people allegedly saw it before it disappeared. Now, that's just an isolated case. And you can go, well, you know, maybe this is something that, maybe tens of dozens of people had a collective hallucination. It potentially can happen. But only a few days later, the same apparition showed up over a bunch of frightened soldiers who actually fired upon this thing. They opened automatic fire against this unknown thing. This unknown show of force, bullets, according to eyewitnesses, splashed harmlessly in the water around the phenomenon. And at times, the machine gun blast could be seen passing right through the phenomenon. Hmm. It was said after these incidents that Cuban authorities tried to brush it all under the carpet. But a researcher by the name of Andreas Kaiser would later speculate that it had been all the result of some type of US naval craft that was off the coast, utilizing some type of advanced technology to project holograms in order to confuse and terrorize the local population as part of a psychological warfare campaign.
What was the image of again? Wasn't it a religious figure?
It was a religious figure. It was the Cuban equivalent of the Blessed Virgin Mary.
But
the reason why it stands out is because the previous report of those strange faces was coming from a naval base as well. So you've got...
I guess you could argue that it's trying to maybe rally the locals against the atheist communist dictatorship.
Probably. Yeah, probably. Now, it's not the first time that the military has tried these sorts of psyops. And we know from, you know, stories like, is it Project Bluebeam and these ideas that you project, you're right, the images of religious figures into the sky, you know, fake alien invasions, like all this stuff apparently at some point has been thought about by think tanks for utilizing some type of military advantage. And as I said, it's not the first time that the Americans have done this. During the Vietnam War, there was Operation Wandering Soul. Not anywhere near as advanced as any of these ideas of utilizing utilizing holograms. But with Wandering Soul, what the idea was is that there was this belief amongst the Viet Cong, or not just the Viet Cong, it was a Vietnamese belief at the time, that when you die, you have to get taken back to your village. Mm. And if that doesn't happen, then you're left as this wandering, doomed spirit. And so what the American military did is they recorded all these wailing kind of voices and changed the pitch and the tone and started blasting them from their, you know, helicopters. Pretty much, yeah, trying to scare some of the Viet Cong to turn away from their fighting and to leave the battlefield. And apparently in some circumstances it worked. In others, the effectiveness wasn't entirely known. And in some circumstances, it actually affected the locals that were helping the Americans because it was the same belief system. So you can see that there is a history and there can be an advantage to it, but it's not, you know, an exact science by any means. And, you know, this kind of stuff, this sort of technology that is black ops technology, always tends to somehow creep out into the regular world after a number of decades. And that's exactly what happened in 2006. In Japan, for instance, there was a demonstration of what the National Institute of Advanced Industrial Science presented as being a three-dimensional hologram laser. So what this laser would do is you fire it in rapid succession into bursts into the sky. Mm. And what it would do, and this is the funny thing, how it ties in with the story from Cuba, is that, the story from Argentina, is that what it does is it causes heat to be emitted in the air. It creates this crackling kind of effect and it projects an image in the sky. But in doing so, it also creates a strange smell, It causes things to become extremely quiet because it affects the sound waves in the area. Hmm. And it's very consistent. Like, this demonstrated technology is consistent with the reports of the vision seen in Cuba and in Argentina. So it's a little bit unusual that you have this kind of technology following up, and I don't know exactly what to make of it. But then you get into the more extreme kind of ideas, and this is what I was talking about going back to, you know, the research of Simon Harvey, is that you've heard of the Chupas, right? I think many, many years ago I mentioned the Chupas. The Chupas were essentially these strange flying devices. Sometimes they were described as being like cubes or being like boxes. And a whole heap of hunters in Brazil would be sitting in trees at night, and they would be just doing their hunting. It was standard practice to go up and sit in a bluff, essentially. But in the 1970s and through the following decades, there's obviously been smaller reports, but the 70s had a lot of them, is that these hunters would report that all of a sudden these flying things would appear and start attacking them, firing beams at
them. Yeah, that's right.
That they would claim that would sap their energy, completely deplete their energy.
And vampire UFOs.
Yeah, they were vampire UFOs. And some people, unfortunately, did die after being exposed to these things. And, you know, the speculation is that, well, all of this might have actually been the testing of a drone technology with newly developed MASER technology. And the reason why it was done in these regions is because it's an area that has a population that doesn't have ready access to Western media. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's a very different world now. But back then, isolated regions, populations less likely to report it, and it was much easier because of superstition to actually blame it on extraterrestrials and UFOs, and people would believe it. So you could safely test your technology, and who cares if you kill people in the meantime? And, you know, the speculation is that maybe it wasn't actually deliberate that these people were actually being killed. The idea is with some MASER technology. So MASER, like, it basically is a laser. It's a microwave laser. So laser is light. Microwave, obviously, is microwave. Or MASER is microwave. With a microwave technology, what you can do is that when you fire into a person at a certain distance, and sometimes these things can be done at up to 100 meters, you can affect the electroactivity in their brains. You can affect the electroactivity in their heart. And from a distance, you can simply stun a person utilizing this technology. But if you're closer and you're testing this thing, but if you're close enough, you can actually cause someone to suffer from a heart attack as a result of utilizing this weapon. So maybe there was a mistake that was made. These things were fired too close to people. And even recently, in the 1997, there was a New Dawn magazine article that I happened to just kind of flick through. And it published the idea of some American scientists that were looking at a new way of utilizing tasers. Now, tasers, obviously, you know, are quite ubiquitous these days. But back in the 90s, they weren't used by all policing departments. I don't even think Australia was using them at the time. But one of the problems that we have with tasers is that obviously they have a barb on them that has wires attached to it. And, you know, if you shoot...
link into you.
Exactly. I mean, you've got to make sure that you shoot both barbs into the person. It's going to get through their clothes for it to be effective. And even then, it's not entirely effective. There are some people, and especially with the rise of meth, that seem to be almost resistant to the electrical effects of these. There was research that was done that was handed over apparently to the American military, where they could develop a handheld device that utilized ultraviolet and laser technology to essentially fire an electrical beam into a person without the use of wires, without the use of barbs, at a distance, again, of up to 100 meters, that could severely incapacitate someone almost permanently in some circumstances. And so the idea was, the issue that they had at the time, I'm sorry, was that they were trying to miniaturize it to get it into a handheld weapon, and they couldn't at the time. They could get into a large kind of about the size of a few telephone books, but that's, you know, not really something that someone's really going to carry around. But they were working on the technology. I mean, if that's what's in the public domain, imagine what would have been going on in the background if they could demonstrate that those technologies actually work. You know, and then you get into reports of things that have been done, like by Jenny Randles, where, you know, she found a whole heap of cases that were quite the opposite of the work of Preston Dennett, where, you know, Preston Dennett has described UFO healings, where, you know, people have strange UFOs that fly over the top of them and a beam is fired in and they've got a cut on their hand or something like that that doesn't heal, then all of a sudden it heals. Jenny Randles described something quite different. She described that in 1987, this happened on the 17th of March 1987 in Cheshire in England, and there was a man by the name of Ken Edwards. Now, Ken Edwards was driving home from a union meeting or something like that, and he said he saw this glowing white mass that just drifted into the center of the road in front of him. He said it just came out of nowhere. But he says as he was watching this thing, and he says it was a thing because there was an intelligence to it, which is odd, which makes me think that this isn't necessarily some type of testing of technologies, earthly technologies, because I don't think you would assume that it has an intelligence to it. But he says he was watching this thing when all of a sudden two eyes, he uses eyes in inverted commas, opened in this thing, firing two beams of light directly into him. It said it struck him on the hands, like his hands were sitting up on the steering wheel, and it struck him in each hand. Now, he was thrown back by this in the car. He says he felt like he was shaking from the inside out. He said he was shocked by this. He said the car radio blew up and the car vehicle, the engine stopped running. Now, this white mass just kind of disappeared off the road and the engine came roaring back in and he drove home. But when he got home, his wife looks down at his hands. She's like, what happened to your hands? And he was too shaken. And he looks down, though, at his hands and he sees where his hands had been sitting with the knuckles facing outwards for the windshield.
Yeah.
They were all like extremely sunburnt, bright red. Now, it took a few days for this to go down. But what was sad about this is that he progressively began to feel tired and unwell. And the following year, he was diagnosed with cancer. He was only in his mid-30s, but he had an extremely rare version of treatment-resistant kidney cancer. It's only diagnosed in a very, very small number of cases. And his doctors even speculated that he'd been exposed to some type of radiation. And they said, where have you been exposed to radiation? Of course, he's like, I've never been exposed to radiation, apart from potentially the encounter that he had that evening. So is this some type of longitudinal test that's being conducted? Or is it
we just have plenty of reports of people having cancer after UFO close encounters as well.
Very much so. Yeah, very much so. And, you know, like I was describing with the whole idea of invisibility, because it's not that different. And this is what was pointed out, you know, in the articles. When I was describing the cases of invisibility, it's a manipulation of light. And when we look at the physical properties that some of these strange UFO light beams seem to have, it's not just, you know, you can utilize it for invisibility. You can also utilize it for weaponry. You know, but he also points out that sometimes it could be utilized for probing of information. What I like about him is he tries to link a lot of these old stories in with modern scientific advances. So one thing that comes up is that in Brazil as well, while all this chupa activity was taking place, around the same time, we're talking the same decade, there was also a weird incidence of people being struck by small UFOs. Like they weren't big enough to be described as having a human pilot inside. So this is why they were described as being small. So I think it's like about the size of a trunk, or maybe a little bit smaller than a phone book. A phone booth was described. But people were being hit by these things that had beams coming out of them. These beams were striking them, but the beams were much bigger than what was being described by the chupas. The beams were about 10 centimeters, you know, maybe 9 centimeters in diameter, so about, you know, 2 or 3 inches in diameter. When these things struck them, the people described that they felt a sudden change in the way that they felt. It didn't cause them to have basically pain, but it was more like these shocks that were coming into them. Like they were actually coming into them and pulsing through their body and actually changing something in their minds is what was described. Now, some people reported seeing images that would start flashing up in their minds when they were struck by this UFO, when this beam was getting into them. And they just described the being as moving through them and into their body. Hmm. It was like it was infusing them with something. And the speculation is that maybe this was some type of transfer of knowledge or information, rather than it having kind of, because the word, you know, infusing has a sinister kind of overtone that maybe it's like some type of control, but it doesn't seem to be that. It seems like whatever these things were, they didn't understand exactly how to communicate with human beings. So that was like flashing things into them was the only way that they knew how.
Uri Geller's story when he was a kid.
Yeah, I thought about that actually.
Something like
after,
that.
Yeah, after I read that, and I thought that's fascinating because in this circumstance, I mean, maybe they're relaying information, but are they trying to awaken latent abilities that human beings have? And maybe we just don't hear it as often because people obviously like Uri Geller are rare, you know, and maybe people that have these kind of abilities don't want to talk about it because they're, you know, concerned about the ridicule that comes from it.
Maybe they all died of cancer.
Well, that's the other possibility as well. I mean, maybe they've been affected by it. But where it ties in with modern science is that there has been scientific research into the utilization of transmitting knowledge and photographs in microwave weaponry. Well, I shouldn't say weaponry. Weaponry is the wrong word. But in microwave beams
obviously, apparently, according to the research, it never got off the ground.
Not directly into people's heads.
Not directly into people's heads. But
with another receiver that decodes the signal.
Exactly, yeah.
Not boomed right into your freaking brain. What are you talking about?
No, not that advanced. Not that advanced. No, and obviously there's utilization now for microwaves anyway. Like, it can send signals through microwaves. That's how, you know, some radio telescopes work.
To a microwave receiver.
Receiver, yes. Yeah, don't get me wrong. It's not beaming it directly into someone's head, but it's the same principle as what he was describing was being utilized by these things actually directly into a person with possibly an advanced understanding of that rudimentary technology that human beings have tried to build. But then what if it wasn't extraterrestrials at all? What if it was just clandestine or secretive human beings that are attempting to utilize that technology? But we know that microwaves are extremely dangerous. I mean, they'll cook you. That's literally what microwaves will do. Mm. So obviously,
it'd be pretty cool if you could just directly beam memes into people's heads. Just to piss them off.
That would be fantastic. But, you know, you get more unusual cases as well. And actually, this one was found by Jacques Vallée. And this is, I've known of this case for a while. I just didn't realize how it tied in so well with the idea of the properties of these lights that are used by these beings. So back in September of 1989, there was a factory worker by the name of Polyakov, and he was driving in Voronezh. Now, he claims, like the case before, that as he was driving along, he sees this pinkish-yellow sphere that was kind of shining dimly. It was just sitting above the road. But he says when he gets close to this thing, he stops. And he says from the sphere, this protuberance kind of like comes out of the bottom. And he says it was kind of like this bell-shaped growth that you see on some trees. And he says suddenly this light gets emitted from it. It's not very bright, but it was trembling and flickering. Now, this light started swooping back and forward across the ground until it finally hit the inside of his car. Now, he describes that as it hit the inside of his car, he said there were these bluish kind of sparks that were coming off it. It didn't cause any damage to his car, but he said, you know, it was causing these blue sparks that he could physically see. He said everything around it was quivering as if it was like a hot, you know, haze on a hot kind of day. He said then there was this blinding flash that reflected off the surface of his car, much like the report that came from Cuba, which was, you know, supposedly human technology. And he says, as this flash happened, smoke starts pouring out of his radiator as it overheats. So obviously, you know, maybe the microwave angle starts putting heat into his car. And he says, as he's watching, he says he feels something slipping from the light into the car. He claims a being was being transmitted through the light. And he says something appeared on the seat next to him in the vehicle.
Ew.
He said it kind of just appeared, and he said he knew it was there. He said he couldn't see it. He could just see the light. He could see the impression in the seat. And he said for some reason he reached out to touch this thing. He said, I could feel it. And he said it was definitely there. Now, when he touched this thing, he said it felt unpleasant. Like there was this unpleasant thing. He became paralyzed by it. And he claims that this thing made him feel like a rabbit being hypnotized by a cobra. He said it was kind of just waving back and forward as it sat in the car. He said then immediately the ray moved away. His breathing came back because he realized he'd stopped breathing for a moment as this was taking place. Everything was dark and quiet for a moment. And then the dashboard of his car lit back up. The radio came back on as if nothing happened. And he was able to drive home.
Did the thing ever manifest or he didn't see it directly? It
never manifested. He only felt it. But he was insistent that it came in through the light. So maybe some type of weird transporter technology? I don't know what to think of it because it never actually manifests.
Sounds like some kind of government hologram project.
Well,
if you
possibly,
ask me.
Yeah, possibly. You know, and you know, we hear more stories though of like these weird lights that are, you know, being utilized. I mean, a really good example: Linda Moulton Howe, you know, experienced this in her research that she did in Puerto Rico into, you know, some of the reports of catamutilations that were taking place down there. And in 1995, there was a Mrs. Enrique Gonzalez. I'm sorry. And she was with her six-year-old daughter. Now, there'd been a whole spate of weird cattle mutilations that were taking place. But obviously, everyone wasn't getting involved in it. People weren't too scared to go outside. But around 11:30 p.m., so it was still actually light because it was this warm summer evening. So it's not that unusual that they're outside. But they said that when they were outside, they heard a scream. And that's unusual for... No, it wasn't that. It was a human scream that they heard. Now, they went running over. And when they went running over, they saw what they claimed was this huge, round, glowing object. Now, they watched this object as it almost got their attention, and it got, well, they got its attention, and it started moving towards them. Now, as it moved towards them, it suddenly projected this red pencil beam,
out of the bottom of the ball and fired it into the girl's upper arm. Now, immediately, Mrs. Gonzalez, you know, grabbed hold of a little girl and went running home. And when she got home, she found that there was this reddened skin in this perfect circle that had bubbled up. It actually had blistered up after being fired at by this thing. There were several bumps, and they finally disappeared after a couple of days. Now, this could be anything that could be happening from this. I mean, the weird circle is kind of unusual. But where it fits in is if you go back to the reports of the chupas that were happening back in the 70s, the reports that were coming from people that survived those things is that they had similar circular bubbling that was taking place. On top of that, a doctor that was doing a lot of those cases. So the thing was, it was happening in a very specific region. So obviously the people that were being attacked by these things were going to the same hospital. So the doctor that was on call there or was working there, he noticed, first of all, that they had these strange burns where these lights had gone in. But he then noticed that there were two pinpricks or like needle marks that were in the center of these burns and this bubbling. And he said it was hard to the touch. So why would
that? Like a remote way of taking a sample or something.
That's what I'm beginning to think. It's really unusual. So when you tie it in with the phenomenon of the cattle mutilation, I mean, I know it's a couple of decades later, but it's seemingly describing, at least from a physiological standpoint, the same type of injuries that take place. Now, I know it's the human body. I know that the human body obviously reacts similarly to heat and reacts similarly to burns and that kind of thing. Like there's kind of a standard range of how the human body will behave. But when it comes to these weird lights, for it to be able to do something like this, first of all, it has to be a very, very advanced technology, but it also has to be very specific to elicit this type of reaction in such a surgical style of precision. So this isn't just people accidentally, you know, burning themselves with a lighter or, you know, holding a magnifying glass out in the sun and getting a couple of burns. There's something more sinister going on here. Now, whether it's extraterrestrials or whether it's human beings testing and blaming it on extraterrestrials, we're not meant to know. But it makes you have to think, what is occurring here? I mean, are we just at risk of these things? Are we just vulnerable because we have no knowledge of what is occurring with these things? But where I wanted to go with this and move into the kind of the next area about this is we come back to the micronoids. And, you know, whenever phenomena takes place, whenever there seems to be kind of activity, whether it's UFOs appearing, Bigfoot encounters, even poltergeist experiences, you know, we're talking about the Yugas on this show, it seems to occur in cycles. It seems to occur around the same times. Flaps will start up in particular areas. They'll go for a certain period of time and they'll end abruptly. And they seem to be cyclic sometimes in fashion. Now, 1973 in Pennsylvania was a really great example of this. You had the excellent Stan Gordon research, where he looked into the connection between UFOs and Bigfoot. Whole heap of activity took place, then all of a sudden, it was gone. It ended. The same thing was happening in Malaysia. And there are a lot of reports that started slowly in the late 1960s and then exploded in 1973. And it related to the minioids or the mini extraterrestrials. Now, these were also known as the micro extraterrestrials. And it relates to cases that really did, even though most of them occurred in 1973, they ranged from 1969 all the way up to 1985. And essentially, Malaysia played host to this very unique breed of alien invader, the micro terrestrials. So apparently, these things stood between 1 inch and 6 inches in height. But the strange thing about these, I mean, apart from the fact that they're already micro.
And they're adorable. That's the strange thing about them.
Well, they're not adorable. Then they're actually quite horrible.
I want to take them home and put them in my dollhouse.
Well, the 3-inch beings always had antennas. They always had antennas. The 6-inch and the 1-inch beings were always just humanoid. But
they're the collectible ones.
Yeah.
You don't want the ones without the antennas. Yeah.
Yeah, they're the really rare ones that you want to make sure that you can sell on eBay. And people did try to capture them. But starting all the way back in July the 2nd of 1969, this was in the capital city of Johor, there was 4 schoolboys that ran into the headmaster's office and they were screaming about this tiny UFO that they'd just seen out in the school. They said that this thing was no larger than a dinner plate. Now, as crazy as it sounds, these 4 schoolboys, and according to the reports, were reliable kids. They weren't prone to making up stories. And even though it does sound like a story that kids could make up, apparently they did seem very sincere. And you have to remember as well, the culture was very different in Malaysia. It was very kind of, especially in the 60s, you know, very matter of fact, very strict. And if you would go and make up these kinds of stories, you potentially could get into a lot of trouble from your parents and from the school. So they told their schoolmaster that they had seen not only this plate-sized UFO that also seen 5 6-inch tall humanoid figures in red uniforms emerge from the craft. According to the boys, they tried to capture one of them, but as they tried to chase after it, they scuffled down a hole, like a drain, that was on the school. They waited until finally the things climbed back, or tried to climb back into their vehicle, and then they just disappeared. Now, obviously, this is when they ran into the headmaster to tell them, and the headmaster went back, not really believing them. It's a strange thing for the boys to describe. But what they found is that there was this perfect, small, round, dinner plate-sized patch of burnt grass on the ground that would have been consistent with what this vehicle was.
You'd have to be pretty ballsy to be an alien race and go and investigate a planet where the natives are 10x your size.
Yeah, well...
like you're a hundredth the size of the locals. You're like, let's go investigate.
I saw this being expanded upon, and I can't remember if it was Stephen... I think it was Stephen Hawking, but maybe it was Michio Kaku. I can't recall. It was one of these pop kind of, you know, physicists. Mm. And they were describing this idea, you know, kind of indulging in this idea about future travels. And I know you're going to go with future, but I'm not necessarily that they're people from the future, but Kaku or Hawkins, whichever one it was, we're speculating that if we eventually were to develop some type of time travel technology as human beings, eventually, we would actually have to be micronized. We'd have to be shrunk down to be able to travel back into the past, to be able to get through. It was this weird hypothesis.
Why?
Right? I don't know. I don't know either, right? I was like, but this was like, apparently there's
in order to extend our resources, we have to shrink you to the size of a pea to send you back in time.
Isn't it like that Rick Moranis movie, like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids kind of thing going on there? But no, there was some physics behind it. And obviously I don't know what the physics were because I'm not a physicist by any means.
Well, if you're going to travel for, you know, an extended length of time through space, it's like that Matt Damon movie where they want to save the planet by shrinking everyone so you use less resources.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I guess that's kind of the principle.
And you just give them a Mars bar. That'll last them a year because they're tiny.
So a year later, right? So this could just be an isolated story and you just go, oh, well, that's, you know, it's a weird, unusual tale, but there's more to it. A year later, on August the 19th in 1970, there was a primary school. It was the Stowell Primary School. And eyewitnesses claimed that they saw 5 3-inch tall humanoids march in military fashion down the gangplank of a miniature flying saucer that had landed in the schoolyard.
I like that they're marching in military fashion. That suggests that they're confident.
Well, they are. I mean, the four beings apparently, four of the beings, it wasn't the four, but it was five beings, but four of the beings wore identical blue uniforms. The fifth carried himself with an aura as being the one in charge and wore bright yellow. Apparently he had stars upon it. Now, these onlookers, you know, were abandoning any concerns about their own safety and tried to capture these things. Now, six boys advanced on these creatures. They ran up to them, grabbed hold of one of them, the leader, when he pulled a tiny laser pistol and opened fire upon the children. The kids scattered in panic when all the hubbub died down. Apparently, one child was able to present a scar that was on his thigh that had supposedly come from the laser pistol. Now, I mean, so that's a year later. A bit unusual.
Are you going to mention the 1972 one from Japan? Have you got that one?
No. What was that?
Oh, remember this one? You put it in the show notes if you don't have it. I thought you'd definitely mention this. The 1972...
Oh, I do remember that one. Yes. Yes. What was that called?
The Kira case. And it's this 13-year-old kid. It's similar to that story you just told where he and his buddies, they see this UFO in a rice field. And I can't remember if they see entities, but it's this mini, it's kind of like a tiny hat. It's this little weird UFO that's hovering and leaving concentric circles in the rice field.
Yeah, I do remember that story. What's fascinating about that, though, is that it's the timing. 1972.
Oh,
it's in the same area of the world. It's very, whatever happened to that craft, though? Because they had photographs of it. Like in all these reports, they don't have photographs of the craft. The craft just disappears. And you know what, though? Where this ties in with the hologram stuff is that in one of these stories, because there were multiple reports, especially in the 1973, again, showing up in a schoolyard, this is the theme that seems to occur.
They put it in their backpack and then tied it up and they felt a tug inside the backpack and the object was gone, they claim.
That's exactly what happened in one of these cases from Malaysia in 1973. The little beings ran off into the wilderness, apparently, and the UFO just went and disappeared. Hmm. So are they holograms?
These little freaks.
They are little freaks. They're horrible little freaks. So this whole laser beam weapon thing, though, it's kind of strange. So apparently in 1973, one of the earliest reports of that year, there was this alarming trend of these UFOs landing on schoolyards. Two young men would insist that they had come into contact with a pair of 3-inch tall humanoid creatures, one of which they managed to capture. When they captured this thing, it was able to escape before they were able to present it to the teacher. Again, though, it produced some type of laser handheld weapon and started firing away. The same year, a second report came in of where schoolboys in, this was Bukit Mertajam. This is in the central kind of region. These young men testified that a small UFO landed in a field where they were playing. They abandoned their game and went over to inspect this thing. And they claimed that they saw these minuscule men walking over to a tree and placing some type of apparatus into a tree. And when they tried to apprehend one of these things, a beam of light was fired at the head of one of the boys who had lunged for the aliens. And he suffered only minor burn damage. But it seems like he actually had been affected by something. So there were physical traces coming from the interactions with these beings. And where we can understand that maybe, well, there could be some type of personal defensive weapon, but maybe they were being used for something else. Because in 1973, towards the middle of the year, this was on the peninsula of Malaysia, it was kind of heading down towards Borneo, there was a group of boys that apparently interacted with a UFO that was very tiny, but had 6-inch beings inside it. But these 6-inch beings were wearing white suits. Like, seemingly, I don't know if they were flight suits or what they were, but they were wearing white suits. But when they came across the UFO that was landed on a field, one of these beings was using a weird laser pistol to cut through the wire fence that was before them. Now, they've disturbed these creatures. These creatures immediately got back inside the UFO and then just flew off into the distance and no further information was included. But maybe these devices act more than just personal weapons. It's some type of cutting device, some type of multi-tool that's being used. So look, I'll link to these in the show notes so you can check them out for yourself. There's many of these reports. There's one report that stands out only in the fact that it happened in one of the beach towns in the south of Malaysia. And it was, again, 1973. And it was the only case reported that year that didn't associate with the school. Every single other case was related to a school. It was only very short. There were 6 or 7 humanoids that suddenly appeared on a beach. They resembled human beings exactly, apart from their tiny size. And then all of a sudden they ran off and no one knew where they were.
What if the tiny people try and take us over?
Just stand on them. Kick its face off.
Just
kick that.
You wouldn't
face
even
off,
know.
Fine. No, exactly.
You might just sit down on one, and you don't even realize.
Yeah, just whatever. So there are plenty of reports of these things, though. Do you remember the story that came out of it was Lahore? Do you remember? I think that was very much when we started MU, like years ago.
Little monkey man or something.
Yeah, it was like a 4-inch humanoid-looking alien that was found in the debris of an old store that was being rebuilt, and apparently this thing was alive at the time when they found it, and it was flopping around this weird fish-like kind of manner, and then the local children threw stones at it because that's what you do. Like, they just assumed that it was dangerous. It was killed, but they actually got the body, and the body shriveled up and burned in the searing Lahore sun, and then all of a sudden the body just disappeared. So they had photographs of this thing, but to me it looks
probably a monkey fetus or something.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Probably.
It's usually what it is.
Probably. But look, I mean, that aside, there is a long tradition when you look into UFO legends of there being these mini microterrestrials that appear that are associated with, you know, different aspects of what I've been describing. You know, the weaponry that's being used, strange beams of light, and then of course there's also the holographic side of things where things just seem to disappear. So, you know, you have to wonder, are people genuinely seeing things? But is this all a massive PSYOP operation?
I think what's happening is they're coming to take one last look at us before the year 2025. Just cataloging as much as they
can.
We're
all screwed. Look, you don't even take my word for it. I mean, even if you look at the work of like Jim Rickards, we're screwed. Like, unless you've got a whole heap of gold, even then, it's like we're in a lot of trouble. Look, personally, I think a lot of it probably is a little bit doom and gloom, like getting a little bit caught up. I mean, people have been saying all these terrible things are going to happen. I was one of them, and it hasn't taken place. So, yeah, maybe we shouldn't be
Except
so negative.
For the people that were saying all these terrible things are going to happen before that 300-year transition period, all those people were 100% correct.
Good point. But what did they do? Did they save themselves? There's no point in being a know-it-all if you just don't save yourself.
I think...
Oh, my God, he's dead.
They're all dead. That's a wrap for this show. Thanks for being on Plus. Enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll catch you on Friday for your next MU. See you then.